This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, today, Friday, is a very important day for Ukraine, for the President, Volodymyr Zelensky, and for NATO, because a big decision needs to be made, and it will be made at Ramstein Air Base, which is in Germany. The American Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, will be there, along with 50 other representatives of NATO, mostly defense ministers. And the issue they will be discussing is the degree to which the arms that Zelensky requires and is demanding can be sent, particularly tanks, which will be important. It is believed and is almost certain that Russia will launch a new spring offensive in the not too distant future. And Mr. Zelensky is making some very hawkish noises about the help he's getting from the West and also about his aspiration for this conflict, which is, he says, among other things, to restore Crimea, which has been occupied by Russia since 2014. We're joined now by one of Britain's most distinguished journalists, John Kampfner. He was bureau chief in Moscow at the time of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. He was then chief political correspondent of the Financial Times and a political commentator for Today, the renowned BBC radio program, and political correspondent for Newsnight. He's also an author of a number of books, the latest of which, Why the Germans Do It Better, Notes from a Grown-Up Country. Now, John, Germany really has a big decision to make, and it concerns the tanks that they have been very reluctant to send to Ukraine, or indeed to allow people, the governments in Poland and Finland, for example, who have got these Leopard 2 tanks from Germany, to allow Poland and Finland to let them go to Ukraine because they have a veto on that. The importance of today's meeting, in your view?
Huge, Eamon. Hi there to you and to listeners. I mean, I always start whenever I'm talking about Germany and its Russia policy with the caveat, as I said in my book, Germany does not do Russia better for so many reasons we've discussed before on your podcast. It's endemic pacifism, the Russophilia, which is partly political through I could get very historical here and talk about the foundation of the Social Democrats, the party that's now leading the government, very sort of closely aligned with sort of Russian revolutionaries in the late 19th century, blah, 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 blah. We could go on about all of that, but we are at the here and now. Germany, through Olaf Scholz, its curious chancellor, now in post for just over a year, who manages to be completely exasperating while just about always getting the job done. And I think that's what's going to happen in this instance at Ramstein and everywhere, all the other issues around Ukraine. Germany is slow it gets there, but it gets there reluctantly. And in so doing, it frustrates its allies. It infuriates, understandably, the Ukrainians. And it doesn't do itself any good. I'm cautiously optimistic that a deal will be struck today with their new defense minister, Boris Pistorius, who is clearly has clearly been brought in to produce a harder edge. His predecessor, Christine Lambrecht, was completely incompetent, which sort of personifies Germany's whole defense.
Yes, and she resigned earlier this week.
That's right. She personified the sort of confusion that Germany feels around defense. And it's all changing. You know, when Putin invaded just coming up to a year ago, and Scholz did that amazing speech, the Zeitenwende, 3 days later, yes. Sunday morning in Parliament, completely blindsided MPs, blindsided most of his cabinet and coalition by being promising to be as radical as he did. Germany has done a lot. It's shipped a lot, but it always does it slowly, reluctantly. And it then gets the hump about why it's not given the credit, because it's always following rather than leading.
It's the most powerful nation in Europe. I don't think many people would dispute that.
Well, it's the most powerful politically and economically, absolutely not in the security realm.
Yes, and its hesitancy, its reluctance, in the case not just of these Leopard 2 tanks, but right the way through this conflict, which goes back 11 months now virtually, Germany has been, as you've pointed out, slow and not, should we say, as bullish and enthusiastic as Britain. Now, for all Boris Johnson's and this Tory government's failures, it has led on this matter. And even yesterday, Wallace, the defense minister, came out and promised tanks. He will be there today, I take it. The Brits have been, I think, very supportive of Ukraine and have been leaders in this. And they're not leaders in many things these days. You couldn't write a book called Why Britain Does It Better.
Well, certainly I wouldn't.
No, with effect. So I don't want to get too bogged down in the history, but is it a hangover from the Second World War or even deeper than that? And is it to do with Germany trusting itself?
Well, I mean, first of all, about Britain, yeah, I mean, as you say, I would hardly be the first in a queue of people rushing to write a book or a newspaper article praising Britain, not as a country, but as a political establishment. The politicians have let this country down for a very long time.
Yes.
Which we could, you know, devote a whole series of programs to, but not necessarily for now. But Britain has, you know, and I struggle to say it, but I have to, give respect where it's due. Johnson was faster than the others on Ukraine. Was that some sort of psychological British tick or Johnsonian tick about always wanting to emulate Churchill, seeing solace in Britain's reputation in the Second World War, and it's hardly been a great forward movement ever since, and sort of wallowing in war mentality and nostalgia? Yes, but it's also the real world, and it's also now. And how do you, if you are trying to, everybody pretty much had given up on liberal democracy, and Macron famously declared NATO to be brain dead. Trump was running rampage, yes. Populists taking over wherever you looked. And it was a pretty bleak position. And it is remarkable, no matter how we feel, how much people might feel frustrated about the lack of forward movement in the last couple of months for Ukraine and the dangers that remain incredibly acute, Europe and NATO, and most importantly, the United States and the transatlantic relationship, have emerged incredibly strengthened from all of this. They've shown a cohesion, both politically, but also a lot of this stuff is practical, is getting the kit out, not just promising it, is getting it out.
Yes, indeed.
All the repair work stuff. So it's been an amazing story. And it's also, I would say, if you're trying to be optimistic about Britain, given Britain a lever back into Europe, if yes. not into the political mechanics of the European Union, to see Britain absolutely at the table, not posturing, but being genuinely practical with other countries, particularly the Nordics, particularly the Baltics, Poland, and others. For people like me who see Britain's role as being in Europe, that's heartening.
Yes, and one could speculate that Putin believed that the West was split. Brexit would have had something to do with it. That Donald Trump's presidency, when he was disparaging about NATO, and in fact, he pointed to the fact that Germany, for example, wasn't giving up its 2% of GDP towards the cost of NATO, which it wasn't.
No.
And a major calculation for him was a divided West that would not come together.
Yeah, emphatically so. I mean, not only that, he assumed, and I think lots of people, not only in Russia, assumed that he would walk into and take Kiev in a matter of days. Ukrainians wouldn't put up much of a fight. The West wouldn't put up much resistance. They might huff and they might puff and they might impose some slightly sort of Pyrrhic sanctions on Russia. But ultimately, nobody would really resist. And the reverse has happened, led by Ukraine, also led by somebody who I think is never given the credit he deserves, and that's Joe Biden.
Yes.
Who quietly, unbombastically, because he doesn't want to provoke Russia, he doesn't want to provoke Putin into something desperate like nuclear or chemical weapons. So he has been foursquare. But the Americans are saying, completely understandably to Europe, it's time for you to step up, which brings us back to the Rammstein conversations, and it brings us back to Germany, because Germany doesn't actually have very much kit itself. It's so run down, its armed forces, that it doesn't have much to give. But it can and must, and I think will, give permission for the other countries, not least the Poles, through export licenses, to send their weapons immediately to Ukraine. And these Leopard tanks are the most... The British tanks are... The Abrahams are fine, but they would require a whole lot of new training, new ammunition. It's the German ones, the European ones, that are the ones that would be most quickly deployable in the Ukrainian theater.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What about Zelensky's bullishness? I mean, he's been, I think, a superb leader of the Ukrainian nation and a superb ambassador in going out to the world and selling the idea of Ukraine and its case. Nevertheless, it seems to me, in, for example, mentioning Crimea this week, that the West is afraid that he might go further than they want. And that, it seems to me, an obvious reason for caution on the part of everybody who is supporting Ukraine, that Zelensky may want, in fact, as he says he wants, to regain all the territory that Russia has taken from Ukraine going back as far as 2008, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, no Western politician will say it, but I'm pretty, well, I know they're thinking it, that, you know, when you have to, there's one thing to have a ceasefire, there's another thing to get a peace deal. We're a million miles away from a peace deal. But yes, what would that entail? No peace deal unless it's absolute sort of First World War, Second World War capitulation. Peace deals usually entail, whether you like it or not, an element of compromise. And it does feel to me, and it's sad to say it on any moral ground, but that Western policymakers would differentiate between the Donbass, between the area that is inherent, yes, to, if you look at a map, to Ukraine, both the areas that were seized in 2014 have been seized since last February, that I cannot imagine any form of peace deal that wouldn't give Ukraine back all of that land, back to its pre-2014 boundaries. That said, I'm not sure that would entail for Crimea. What would be required for Crimea is to give Ukraine, hence the West, some form of naval guarantees, because it's through Crimea that access to the Black Sea,
yes,
is controlled. But whether the Crimea, which has such a complicated history and was given back, quote unquote, by Nikita Khrushchev to the Ukrainians only in the 1950s, that's a much harder nut to crack. And then there's a much wider point here, Eamon, which is, what is, given that Russia is not going to go away, given that Russia, again, sad to say, it is not anytime soon going to become a liberal democracy. It dabbled in it and didn't do it back in the early 90s. Again, one could talk about that forever. But given that that's not going to happen, whether it's Putin or whether it's post-Putin, we're going to have to deal with Russia. And what kind of Russia would, yes, that be? And how will we get to a point, to coin Margaret Thatcher's old phrase, that we can find a Russia and a Russian leader that we can do business with? And that will, you know, this is what the Germans and the French are saying. And it's a hard political message at the moment. It's obviously not one that Zelensky wants to hear. But everybody knows that you will not have stability in Europe with a completely humiliated, capitulated,
yes,
Russia. It's not going to happen.
Yes, well, history would tell the Germans that perhaps more than,
yeah,
than anyone else. But to look forward, let's assume that today the tanks are permitted to be given to the people. The Germans sold them to Poland and Finland, I think Spain also. But
yeah,
the point is, will Germany not send its own weapons, whether they be tanks or other weapons? And the other question is, can we really look at this conflict and see it ending with Putin in charge and rehabilitate?
They're different things.
Yes, I know they are. But the point, have we got to the point after the war crimes committed, the appalling destruction of infrastructure and the killing of murder of innocent people that they have engaged in? Can Russia come back into the among the nations of the world, member of the Security Council in the United Nations with a veto? Can all of that be restored as if nothing had happened?
Well, they haven't lost any of their seats, like in
no,
the UN
I know
or,
that.
Or anything else like that. But no, your point is a valid one. I mean, Putin is, you know, every country just has to deal with whoever is in charge elsewhere. It seems hard to envisage a relationship that is anything but, if not absolutely frozen, then pretty cool with Russia for as long as Putin is in charge, simply because Putin himself couldn't and wouldn't change his tune. He has people forget that actually early Putin in the first year or two was quite pro-Western, did all kinds of things, helped the Americans on Afghanistan, didn't stand in the way of Iraq. Took tea with the Queen, invited Blair to the Mariinsky Ballet in St. Petersburg. It was all an attempt at being nicey-nicey to begin with. And that gradually, over time, faded away, and then obviously spectacularly.
Do we know what tripped that wire?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was privy to one occasion.
You were working in those areas, and yeah. You were in Moscow at the time of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So you'd have a good idea, would you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably in two phases. I mean, there's one, which is the early 90s, the end of history yes. scenario of Francis Fukuyama. The West had won, liberal democracy, quote unquote, had won, capitalism had won. All you need to do, Russia and everyone else, is just sort of, you know, sign under the dotted line here yes. and just be like us. And it was pretty difficult to do that with Russia, a country of that size, whose economy was entirely centrally controlled and in many cases moribund, but also psychologically. I remember being at endless press conferences at the finance ministry, economics ministry, and you literally had Western economists standing at the back, sort of almost being puppet leaders, sort of telling the Russian ministers what to do and say. And I remember thinking at the time, this isn't going to end well. Eventually, and it didn't. But again, then Putin, so obviously then you had the chaos with Yeltsin being drunk, Putin takes over, basically being put in there by the oligarchs. But as I say, Putin did try. Now, he tried within his own mindset, and his yes. mindset is a very strong KGB mindset to reach an accommodation. And there is such a deep-rooted, I don't like sort of ethnocentric generalizations, but, you know, so I hesitantly say there is a deeply rooted Russian fear of and anger towards a sense of A, not being taken seriously,
yes.
B, being taken for granted, C, physical encirclement, because they have such huge borders.
Yeah, and that last point, John, if I may interrupt you, of being encroached upon by NATO, surrounded by NATO, a promise has been broken there, hasn't it? A promise that NATO would not move further to the east.
Well, yeah, I mean, nobody in NATO can, the people in NATO say that nobody can actually point to a promise that was made. There will be no further NATO movement to the east, and the Baltics would have been absolutely yes. insistent that they be part of it. But I mean, you know, that sense of betrayal, quote unquote, that Putin feels and felt as early as 2004-05. And, you know, I was at an evening with him with a group of people back in, I've written and talked about this many times, but back in 2004, in which he went on for hours about, look what I've done for you guys. You know, I helped you with Afghanistan, didn't stand in the way of Iraq, didn't stand in the way of European Union enlargement, didn't stand yes. in the way of the Balts and NATO. And what do? You just spend all your time fomenting, quote unquote, unrest in Georgia, in Ukraine, famously, and elsewhere. You know, what do I get from being friendly yes. with you people? And that's basically, and one thing led to another.
And the other quote attributed to him is when asked what was the worst thing that had happened in mm-hmm. his lifetime, he said the disintegration and failure yeah. of the Soviet Union. So there is a kind of a zeal there, maybe even a sort of a sense that he must do this.
Well,
and
this is what
Russia is. Russia is a great nation. And these Baltic countries are part of it, or should be.
Well, it's interesting the use of the term, we could get very academic here, the use of the term nation. There yeah. is a Russian phrase, Ruski duch, which means Russian soul.
Yes.
Sort of Russian spirit. And there is a sort of Russian-ness that isn't defined by borders and nation. It's basically a sort of Slav self-awareness, which then takes you over the border into Belarus, which, you know, was called White Russia, you know, Bielorussia, yes. and Ukraina, Ukraine, which was originally on the edge. And so you get that sense of a sort of, mixing my metaphors here, a sort of Russian Lebensraum, where they yes. see the sort of the Russian soul as extending beyond its borders. Clearly, it had nothing to do with the Baltics. It's got nothing to do with Central Asia, the Caucasus, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, etc. But Ukraine, the Russians feel to be part of them, part of, yes, you know, sort of umbilically linked. And some Ukrainians pre-war would have agreed with that. I mean, many Ukrainians spoke Russian as their mother tongue, and many Ukrainians couldn't speak Ukrainian. Now you can't survive for a minute in Ukraine without speaking Ukrainian.
Yes, and that's true in the Donbass, for example. In that region, many identify as Russian.
Yeah.
And this makes it all the more dangerous, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so Ukraine is geographically, I mean, it's not absolutely clear-cut, but broadly, the further west you go in Ukraine, the less Russian it is. And in fact, you know, the very western parts of Ukraine used to belong to Poland. So it's, you know, it was a divided country. And again, it's one of those remarkable unintended consequences of Putin's terrible decision to invade, is that whereas Ukraine was split and was, you know, and Zelensky came to power in 2019 saying, you know, I can work with Putin. You know, we've got to work with Russia. Russia is next to us. You know, there was a tacit acknowledgement of the link, yes, between Ukraine and Russia. What Putin has managed to do is to embed Ukraine in Europe through the European Union, not through, yes, NATO, and Western values psychologically forever. That border, wherever it is eventually drawn, is going to be a much harder border than it ever was before.
Yes, and Finland and Sweden, isn't it? They both want to join NATO.
Yeah, absolutely. Who would have thought? I mean, yes, you know, the whole Finland's always been frightened, rightly so, of Russia and adopted all the way through the Cold War a policy not of neutrality, but of caution towards Russia. Sweden was always outside, and now they are absolutely hardline towards Moscow.
Just two more questions, John. You expect, I gather from what you said earlier, that today's meeting in Ramstein Air Base will yield for Ukraine some results in terms of tanks, if not by any means everything that Zelensky probably needs and is looking for.
Yeah.
And the other question I want to ask you really finally on behalf of our listeners is, where is this going? Is this going to be long? How dangerous is it? This conflict doesn't, I wouldn't claim to be a great military strategist, but I don't see a nice end. I don't see an end at all.
Well,
unless Putin is toppled from within.
The only thing one can say for certain, and predictions of any description are impossible. They're a mug's game, but we all, right, do, we all make them. But the only thing you can predict with certainty is that it will end, because all wars eventually do.
Of course.
How long it takes, there doesn't seem to be any prospect of any resolution to this anytime soon. We will probably be, talking about this in a year's time. Where it will lie then, who knows? And that's why the decision's being taken now, because of the weather, there's very little infantry-style movement that takes place because of the land in Ukraine until the snow thaws. And so depending on the weather, we're talking February, March, April. But then, as you said right at the beginning, Eamon, there will be a new Russian offensive. And so therefore, the decisions taken now are absolutely crucial. How bad is Russian morale? Well, it's been pretty terrible. All the Russians seem to be doing with limited success is lobbing missiles in population centers and,
yes,
energy centers in Ukraine. But the war will return. And what happens between the anniversary of the invasion, end of February 24, where people are expecting some sort of spectacular, either before, during, or after, and then into the spring months, I think we can cautiously say, but I'm no military expert, that what happens in the next few months will be incredibly important to the military and political outcome for both countries and for the wider Europe.
Okay, John, we're very grateful to you for joining us from London. John Kampfner is a very prized guest on this podcast. So we're grateful to John, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.